It's time for what Podcast International called the greatest podcast in history. Open your ears, because it's time for Man Thoughts with Brian Callen.
All right, everybody, what's up? You are listening to Man Thoughts. I'm Brian Callen. By the way, let me give you my upcoming tour dates. I'll be at Yuck Yucks in Calgary, October 11th through the 13th. So get your tickets. I love that place. And then I'm going to be at the Fort Lauderdale Improv, October 18th to the 20th. Follow us on Twitter at ManThoughtsBC and like us on Facebook. And also don't forget to visit our website, manthoughts.com. All right. And by the way, oh, guys, I need a t-shirt design, man, for Man Thoughts. So it comes with a $500 prize, and I'll wear it and all that stuff. But I need a t-shirt design for Man Thoughts. So come up with one, man. I need one. Something I'm going to actually wear on stage. Something I would actually wear. I don't want to sell anything I wouldn't wear. All right? So there it is. All right. I'm very excited. I've got Dr. Howard Wasdin here. He's the author of SEAL Team 6. I've had just a preliminary conversation. You know, this is Man Thoughts. You want to talk about a man. This guy was a SEAL Team 6 commando, and then he went on to be a chiropractor, a bio... we'll talk about this. Dr. Howard Wasdin, you want me to call you Howard? Welcome to Man Thoughts. Thanks for joining us. How you doing?
You bet, Brian. Glad to be there. How's things in California?
Not bad, my friend. Sunny and always mild, so it's great. And you're down in Georgia, right?
Yeah, down in South Georgia.
Now, you explain to me before we get into the SEAL team. You're a biophysician as well.
Well, there's a type of chiropractic called CBP, which is chiropractic biophysics.
Okay.
Yeah, chiropractic biophysics, and that's what I mostly employ in my practice.
Well, you know, I was telling everybody, people always ask me what books to read. Let me tell you right away, guys. Pick up this book. I literally didn't even know that Howard had written a book until last night. So I didn't want to interview you without having read the book. I jumped in this book. I read a lot. It's so well written, and I could not put it down. It's so fascinating, and I want to read to you guys. I just want to read to you guys how he opens the book, and it's by a legendary Marine gunnery sergeant called Carlos Hatchcock. He was a Marine Corps sniper, and Dr. Wasdin was a sniper in SEAL Team 6. And he starts the book with this quote: "I like shooting and I love hunting, but I never did enjoy killing anybody. It's my job. If I don't get those bastards, then they're going to kill a lot of these kids dressed up like Marines." And I read that, and I was just hooked. And the thing about your book, Howard, is you go into every detail, everything I love about, like, you know, everything guys love details, from the Sig Sauer you carried and why that's a great gun to you know, just, and you know, you're very forthcoming about actually taking, you know, let's be honest, killing somebody from a long way away. I mean, you really saw combat. You got shot. You almost lost your leg in Mogadishu. By the way, that was an event that I followed as a layman as closely as I could. I met a number of guys when I went out to Afghanistan and did stand up for some of the troops. I met some of the guys who had actually been in that firefight. So I can't imagine what you went through. I'm fascinated with, I want to start with the first question, which is, you were really the first guy to write this book about SEAL Team 6, which was always considered very taboo. Recently now, there's a book that's come out, on the Osama bin Laden mission, which was also very sort of controversial, I know, among the special operations community, at least. Explain to me why you felt the need to write this book.
Okay, I'll explain the need, but first of all, the SEAL Team 6 was written about by the guy who founded SEAL Team 6, Richard Marcy.
Right, right.
Back in the early
Right,
90s.
Rogue Warrior, right.
Yeah, Rogue Warrior. So, you know, that was kind of out there. But the big reason why I wrote the book had nothing to do, Brian, with, like, pounding my chest, look at me, I'm a badass.
Absolutely, I get that right away. Yeah. I got that right away.
The reason I wrote the book was I wanted to, like, show about overcoming adversity. Mm. You get into it a little bit in the book when you first start it, but I want every kid out there, which is why we've got two versions of the book, an adult and a youth adaptive version. I want every kid out there to know that regardless of how bad you got it at home, if you're like me and you were adopted at a real young age and then, you know, were abused for years, and even to this day, my mother, for example, who was also abused, still is in denial. Mm. I want those kids that read this book to say, you know what, I live in the greatest country in the world. As long as I just survive this, I can overcome this and I can achieve anything I want to do. I mean, look at my circumstances there. And born into poverty, existed poverty, abused, and still, because I was born into the United States of America, I was able to achieve a pretty good amount of stuff. I mean, I don't know how many SEAL Team 6 snipers, best-selling authors, doctors, pilots there are out there, but, you know.
Let me answer the question. Not many, okay?
That's just saying.
I love it.
Keep your faith. Survive that. Get away from it. And if you're in that, and here's for my step siblings out there. If you're out there, break the cycle. You know, that's what has to happen. If you're in those type of situations, you have to break that cycle. And that's what I did. And that's why writing this book was so therapeutic for me, Brian. And then the other part about overcoming the adversity was, you know, I was shot 3 times in Mogadishu, Somalia. I come back. I go through a divorce. I have got survivor's guilt. I lost my best friend there in Mogadishu. I still have contact with his son, who's 19 now, who's in college playing baseball, but I lost him. I come back, and all that's going on. Think I might lose my leg, almost die of a staph infection, going through a divorce, lost my best friend. Now I'm getting out of a job that I love. And listen, I loved being at SEAL Team 6. That was my life.
Oh, yeah.
That above everything, and which is why I had the divorce, which is why I'm part of the 92% divorce rate in that team.
92%. I've always heard that if you're not a special forces guy unless you've got at least one divorce under your belt and you own a motorcycle.
And that's a terrible thing. You know, I got the Harley and the t-shirt to prove it. Think about that. I was putting the team first and before family, before everything, and loved that lifestyle. So when I'm sitting in that wheelchair and all those things that happened, you know, in addition to the survivor's guilt, I was in a pretty dark place, Brian. And to sit there holding a 6 hour in your hand, thinking there's worse things than living, or you know, worse things than death,
sure.
And actually thinking about ending your life, that's about as low as you could get. That's at a very low spot.
But let's talk for a second, Howard, about, you know, you said break the cycle. And that's one thing to say to kids. But, you know, I always tell people, Howard, I always say, look, man, a lot of times change the primary question you're asking yourself every day. You know, people wake up in the morning and they ask themselves usually a very self-defeating question. Usually it could be something like, am I lovable? What if I fail? Something in that variation. And I found a great deal of success in just changing that question, man. I ask myself every day, I said, what do I have to do? What action do I have to do, what take today to get to who I want to be? And the first thing, by the way, it starts with defining yourself, defining who you want to be. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, you know, what mental mechanism, what kind of questions did you change in your head to get yourself from that to that very low place where you're sitting in a wheelchair with a gun in your hand contemplating suicide to becoming what you are now, which is a healer. What maybe for some young people, is there something that they could change in their mental pattern?
Yes. First of all, you got to realize this, because I grew up not realizing this. You got to realize when something's wrong, and that is wrong. If you've got a young child, 7, 8, 9 years old, that you're beating with the belt so bad that they're bleeding, they can't sit down because their backside is bleeding, you've got to realize that's wrong. Now, listen, I go into the book and say that the man who raised me, my father, that's the way he was raised too. So he didn't know any better. To him, he was beating the meanness out of me, literally.
Yeah, he was trying to toughen you up.
Yeah, and making me a real man. And I say later in the book, you know, when I was in places like boot camp and even times at Bud's going through SEAL training, I'd see these guys whining about stuff, and I'm like, man, are you kidding me? Feeding us? All we got to do is make our bed, say yes, sir, do some push-ups, sign me up. You know? But the first thing to answer your question, I want to answer this in two parts. First thing is you got to realize when something's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
then you got to realize, hey, as long as there's life, there's hope. And that's what happened to me as a young man, and then that's especially what happened to me in a wheelchair. And in the wheelchair, when I was sitting there contemplating that, I realized something, Brian, and I realized, if you ever find yourself in the dark and you're away from the light, it was you that moved, not the light. So I had to reestablish my relationship and my faith in God and realize, you know what? I had become somebody impossible to maintain. In my book, I describe the first time I got shot as feeling like, you got to be joking. I'm Howard Wasden, tactical God. Been in, you know, combat before. 752 parachute jumps. I'm a SEAL Team 6 sniper, you know, at my age, and I've seen guys get hurt on both sides of me, seen guys get killed around me, and I've never had a scratch. And at that point, I was thinking that I didn't need anybody or anything else except me, because I had myself up on a level that was, first of all, delusional, self-delusional, and second of all, impossible to maintain.
Yeah, well, I that's really interesting that you say that. I've never heard anybody put it that way. I became impossible to maintain. And what it sounds like you're saying is that you realized through this insane crisis that there is something out there that is much bigger than you are. Something which
can I put it, but that's exactly what I was saying, Brian.
Yeah, which you can't, is something that you cannot measure. And I think that human beings, it's always my argument for God. I always talk to atheists about this. You know, I don't know how to define God personally, and I don't really know how to, you know, I know there are different definitions, and I know there are different kinds of things you can do, whether you can open a Quran or the Bible or whatnot. But I do think that there is something very humbling and very inspiring about the notion that there is something much bigger and much better than we are out there. And I think that's where religion comes from. I think that it's what's so interesting of hearing, just talking to you in such a short time, is how much gold there is in crisis and how much can be, how much good. I guess the Buddhists always say it takes shit to make a flower, right? And you, when you've been through all the things you've been through, you come out of it if you can manage it, if you can learn to manage it, and maybe even surrender, you know, the things that you've held on to, the things that define you. Because it sounds like you defined yourself along very strong and even mythological lines. You know, I'm Howard Watson, I'm the baddest motherfucker on the planet. When in reality, You had a very rude awakening. Hey, I'm a human being, and I better latch on to something that's much bigger than myself.
And that's exactly right. And what happened during that whole thing, like on the first gunshot, like I said, I was like incredulous. I can't believe I got shot.
By the way, Howard, I got to just tell you, that's about as macho as it gets. Like, I mean, every man would like to be like, instead of getting shot, most of us would start screaming and pull our pants, and you were like, ah, I got shot. I can't believe it.
Anyway, that was terrible to put it that way, but it's true. And the second time I got shot, I was like, and that was a really bad one. The second shot almost blew my right leg off. I was like, wow, these guys aren't screwing around. First time, because God knew, being a hard-headed person that I was, that it took three times. So the third time I got shot, I was like, okay, somebody's trying to tell me something. What is it?
The way you put this, I swear to you, this is going to be on my stand-up, in my next stand-up special. I'm telling you right now. Ah, bam, ah, I can't believe they just shot me. Ah, second one. These guys aren't playing around. Boom. Oh, these guys are trying to get my attention here. That's beautiful. Okay, so now they basically got your attention. It took three rounds from an AK-47.
And then the thing after that, coming back home, that wasn't really the low point, being shot. But that was the point where I realized, hey, I'm only human, and oh my God, that blood coming out of me looks just as red as it does coming out of anybody else. That was me coming back down to human level.
Right.
And as arrogant and as terrible as that sounds, that's really what it was. And I came back, and for a long time, Brian was just miserable, a miserable person. I'm going through jobs that I don't like, raising a son by myself, you know, just not really content with what I'm doing. And then one day, I meet this feisty little redhead, and she convinces me that, hey, you know what? You're wasting your time. You're spinning your wheels. And guess what? I didn't like being talked to like that. I've been single all these years. I had a shelf life on girlfriends. After I'd had you for like 2 weeks, you're done.
I hear you, brother. I hear you.
Okay, so then she comes along, and she basically hammers into my head, guess what? You can't keep doing this tactical game forever, because I was getting ready to go to Brazil doing some work there. And she's like, you need to do something else that will redefine you, that you would love to do. Think about what it is you'd like to do. And then I'm like, good gosh. You know, then I thought about it, and, you know, a chiropractor helped me after I got on my wheelchair, take away my hip pain, my neck pain. I'm like, you know what? I'd like to be a chiropractor. And while that probably surprises you and most of your audience, Brian, let me enlighten you here. To be a SEAL, to be a Navy SEAL, is not what you think it is. You're not just somebody made of solenoids, nuts, and bolts who's a machine that Uncle Sam winds you up, points you straight ahead, says, okay, go assassinate, go kill.
Right.
To be a SEAL, you've got to have a love of country, and I submit to you, love of a fellow man that is, like, almost unparalleled. We don't go up there and bust our ass training, die in training, much less combat. You can die just going through buds. You know, we don't do all that because we want to be some macho hero, believe it or not. We do it because we want to be part of the best. And we want to be that person when there's another American in trouble. We want to be the one there take them out. That's love.
Well, you know, that's you bring up something that's so amazing. I always say that the baddest guy on the planet is the guy with the ideology. A guy who truly believes in, and you know, when people ask me what my religion is, I always say my religion is the Constitution. You know, I believe in this Constitution. That's why I believe in this country. That's why I've always been such a patriot, because I lived overseas my whole life, Howard. I grew up all over the world, mostly in the developing world. So until I was 14, I was in countries like Saudi Arabia and Lebanon and Pakistan and the Philippines and India. I saw the other side. I saw what real poverty was. I saw what leprosy looked like when I was a kid. And when I would come to this country, people don't understand what those founding fathers created, how they solved the political problem. I think we're getting away from it a little bit, but I just happen to believe in maximum personal liberty and all that comes with it in that sense. But one of the things that I find so fascinating is that, you know, Freud said people go to war because of hatred. I think he missed the mark. People fight actually for love of country, for love of a way of life, or for what they believe is ultimately, and I'm talking about the vast majority of people, what they believe is ultimately a just cause. I'm not talking about the Nazis here. I'm just talking about the average American GI. I mean, if you look at World War II, as far as most of those GIs, I think it was a very just war. It really was. We were going to war based on the notion that we were fighting something called fascism. The Cold War was about fighting something called communism, both of which are totalitarian regimes, both of which, in my opinion, are evil, are essentially evil structures of government.
Just as evil as terrorism.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. The new enemy now is Islamic fundamentalism. It's not Islam, it's Islamic fundamentalism. It's this notion that there's a purity. Anytime you have a philosophy out there that deals with the notion that you can perfect or purify a human being, you better watch out. and so you bring up a really good point that I talk about all the time. I'm glad you said that, because what makes somebody a real badass, ultimately, you've got to have a philosophy to moor into, right? You've got to have principles and a philosophy and a faith to moor into, which is what you're talking about here.
That's what a real warrior would rather heal than kill. And that's the way it is. A real warrior would rather heal than kill. Now, back when I was doing counterterrorism, I would have loved to, like, solve the world's problems with doing a group hug, singing Kumbaya, but that's not going to work for everybody. Some people just need a bullet through the freaking melon, you know? I was glad to do that, but in my heart, I was doing it out of love of country and love of fellow man, and that's what most people will never get. I talked to George Mason University a couple weekends ago, and I surprised a lot of the people in that audience, because usually when I show up to speak, they're just expecting this
knuckle-dragger, yeah.
That has to show up and, like, talk about, you know, the teams and everything. And when I really take the rug out from under them, Brian, is when I start talking to them about love, passion in your heart, the stuff you got to do. Then they start looking at me like I'm from Mars, because that's not what you think of a special forces guy, of a Delta Force, a SEAL, you know, a recon marine, any of that stuff. But the people who do this for a living and spend their life doing it, it's out of love. It's out of love for a fellow man. And think about this. Greater love hath no man than to lay down his life for a friend. And every day these guys are out there willing to lay down their lives for something that we have in the United States. And thank you so much for talking about how good we got it here. I've been to the Philippines. And anybody, I want to take some of these morons, like some of these movie stars who say you're going to leave the country, not to call any names, Alec Baldwin, but I want those guys over to, like, Makati, Baguio, Occidental Mindoro in the Philippines. Show them what real poverty's like and how bad that they've got it, and then come back to the United States and say, okay, nobody who was born in this country deserves to be an American. And I put that in my presentations too, and I get these looks like, oh my God, what's Dr. Watson talking about? Think about what I'm saying, Brian. Nobody did a damn thing to deserve being in this country.
Howard, I think about it. I think about it all the time. I think about it all the time.
God or chance or whatever you want to call it, you ended up in the greatest country in the world for sheer luck. If you'd have been that same kid born in Occidental Mindoro, you'd be the guy grabbing my bonka boat when I come up to the beach barefooted when you're 5 years
that's
old.
That's it. And that's a great point. And that's certainly the perspective I grew up with, which is how lucky I was. And one of the things as a kid, here I was, this American, I'd never gone a day without food and everything else. And I'd go in there and I'd see people on the street, either with leprosy or whatever. And this was in the 70s and even in the 80s. And I just couldn't understand it. It threw my whole paradigm. These children coming up to my father, I remember, my father's a big man, these little children, these little brown children coming up in Pakistan and India and in Yemen, begging for food. I just couldn't get it, man. I just, it didn't make any sense that I felt so lucky. Why was I lucky? I was just, it was literally the math fell on my side. But I want to talk a little bit. I want to move this conversation over now, Howard, to your point of view on foreign policy. You know, Mark Twain, Samuel Clemens said, "Loyalty to my country always, loyalty to my government only when it deserves it." And to defend certain people who criticize it, I think critique of this country is important. I think when you criticize our government's actions, I think sometimes that can be important. And I especially think it can be important during war, because sometimes countries fight unjust wars. I'm not going to go into what they are, but I think that to defend certain actors, let's say like Cher, I don't know Alec Baldwin's position on him. I just think he's funny, but I think a lot of times, like someone like Cher, really, she spent a lot of money sending sort of equipment over to the guys, hockey helmets and stuff. And she was emotional about it. But, you know, what she was trying to do was basically save American lives by being critical and vocal about the effort. Now, whether or not that's a good way to do it or not, it's a different subject. But I wanted to talk to you a little bit about your point of view on foreign policy. Let's take Iraq and Afghanistan. What we've seen in Afghanistan is it's probably never been a country, first of all. It's always been a series of tribes. Iraq, a different story. I understand the argument for going into it. But the worry now becomes that we leave behind a broken country that's just as bad or just as poorly, just as bad off as it was when we got there. Maybe it's not as big a threat to the United States. But the notion is that, you know, we've become very good at killing with drones, and we have our killer elites that do a very good job. The question is, what is the end game? And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how you feel about the Iraq and Afghanistan war, and how to avoid a situation in the future. How do we become more effective at the mission and what we're trying to do? I guess that's what I'm asking you.
Well, to become more effective, that end game that you just spoke about, we should know what that is before we ever go in.
That's a good point.
My take on it. Now, here's the thing. As far as Iraq goes, I was in, the Gulf Storm or Desert Storm. I was there the first time. We didn't finish the job then, so then we have to go back and finish it later. I think Iraq happened as a knee-jerk reaction because we just had the Twin Towers come down, 9/11 happened. Okay, here's our back over here. We know they've got weapons of mass destruction, whatever, whatever. Now, did an evil, maniacal regime get taken out by going over and taking out Hussein and his sons? Yeah, that happened. Do I think the quality of life in Iraq is better now? Yes, probably so. But was it worth all the lives we lost? Was it worth us going back in and finishing something we should have finished earlier? And look at it from this aspect. Iran was not a threat to us while Iraq was still under Saddam Hussein.
Exactly.
So think about that.
Exactly.
But here's what I'm going to say, and I'll talk about Afghanistan in a minute. I want to keep this to the men and women in the armed forces. The minute that we decide, hey, we're going to pull the trigger, we're going to go in, we're going to do this as a nation, my only request is that the people in this nation support the troops, not the idiot up in the Beltway who made the call, whoever they might be. Whatever
right.
decision is made, and once we're on the ground over there, let's finish the job and come home. And that's what I mean by finish the job.
Yep.
We didn't finish the job in Mogadishu, Somalia. And by the way, come to one of my presentations. We had that one. I don't know how many people realize that, Brian. We had one in Mogadishu, Somalia. We had one bad day. We broke their back that day. And we had it won. And what do? We tuck tail and run. And look at all the people still starving.
Exactly.
Over there.
I was going to say that. You're right, Howard. I mean, if you followed that conflict, we did have it won. And what happened was we lost a bunch of soldiers. We had some Delta guys dragged through the streets, which was terrible and stomach turning. But at the end of the day, Somalia is now finally maybe coming out of a nightmare. Maybe they weren't even a country. It was just bands of marauding militiamen who did what they wanted. How, and guess who suffered? Women and children. So you're absolutely right about that.
And it made me feel good to be a part of that UNISOM and see the bad guys being taken out, running a safe house where my agents were getting us information, we were taking out the lieutenants, killing these people called Al-Qaeda, which America had never heard of, just doing all this stuff over there. And look, once we left Mogadishu, Somalia became an incubator for Al-Qaeda.
Yeah.
You know? And
yeah.
Who knows if we'd have finished our job there, you know, if 9/11 would have ever happened. Moving along to Afghanistan there, I got sidetracked. Afghanistan, I think, is a little different than Iraq. On Afghanistan, we did have the Taliban and there helping Al-Qaeda and all that. Al-Qaeda, to me, the minute that the towers were hit, they became, in my opinion, priority one. I don't care about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq unless you've got some Al-Qaeda people over there. Then we'll go take care of both. But Afghanistan is different for me because I think that, first of all, I think we've broken Al-Qaeda's back. There's probably a lot of splinter organizations out there, Brian, that have splintered off or that were sympathetic toward them. I'm sure there are. But we had to go into Afghanistan.
Well, you know, Howard, what I always say about that is this. When I remember, you know, I worked right near the Twin Towers, okay? And my buddy lost his brother. And when I saw those planes hit, the biggest question was this. We knew that Afghanistan was harboring what they called Al-Qaeda, which means the base in Arabic. We knew they had those guys. We gave them 2 weeks to give up those guys. They didn't do it. A lot of people forget that we gave them 2 weeks, right? And then the bottom line is, we went in there because we didn't know. A lot of people don't realize, you know, if you read like Bob Woodward's book, he's not some right-wing guy. If you read Bob Woodward's book, he was with these guys. It's called Bush at War. We didn't know what the threat was. We didn't understand what was coming next. We didn't know if there was going to be a mushroom cloud over an American or European city. And when you're the president of the United States, you've got to answer that question. People are saying, "Hey, Mr. President, how are you going to guarantee we don't see a mushroom cloud over American or European or any other city?" That is a very real question. And when you're at the helm of power, you have to have an answer to that question. And the other thing I always say is that, you know, say what you will, at the end of the day, people forget we were feeling very unsafe. And 10 years later, we're not feeling unsafe. Nobody walks around the streets of New York or anywhere else anymore and worries about a terrorist attack. And that's significant. Okay. And guess who deserves credit for that? The military.
Credit for that. Our military, of course, deserves credit for that. But you got to remember, under a previous administration, our intelligence sources were cut to the bone. We've had to revamp those. And part of the reason you're talking about walking around feeling safe now is for a while we did have a president who would say, "Hey, I don't care what it costs, pay to get these guys trained up, get us some intelligence sources, human intelligence, signal intelligence, and let's get all this up." Because basically, no matter how you want to slice it, we got caught with our pants down on 9/11. We should have known about that. We should have had the intelligence people on the ground, and that never should have happened. And it never should have happened, and nobody likes to talk about this either, from security screening, getting on the airplane. That should have never happened.
Right.
You know, so.
That's right. That's right.
I'll tell you what I think is more problematic now than that. I think we've pretty much got the intel sources in place now, and our troops are kicking butt. My son-in-law is a dog handler over in Afghanistan right now on his fourth tour.
Hey, you know, I was out there. And they let me put a bite suit on. They let some of those dogs loose on me. I got on a video. I got to post that, actually. Let me tell you, man, those dogs are no joke.
They don't mess around.
No, they don't. I got hit by these Belgian Malinois. Those are wolves, man. Those are wolves.
In my backyard right now, who's a retired hero. And I go home and play with that dog every day. And he's smarter than a lot of people we know.
Oh, yeah. They're, if you ever want a real good man stopper and a very smart dog, Belgian Malinois are where it's at.
Here's what I think our problem is more so than Iraq or Afghanistan. You know, Afghanistan is going to always be, like you said, a bunch of different clans, tribes, whatever. When we leave, they'll fall back into whatever. I don't think it'll be as bad, and I think they'll think twice about harboring people like Al-Qaeda.
Right.
Iraq, on the other hand, I think Iraq was pretty much a success, just given the fact that, hey, these people aren't living in fear. They're not being killed by the thousands, gassed like they did the Kurds and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I think our biggest problem right now is paying to have allies. For example, paying Egypt to be our buddy,
yep,
which they're not. I promise you they're not. The president wants to be political and say they're not allies, but they're not enemies. Listen, if you're not an ally, you might be the friend of my enemy, but you're either an ally or a friend, or an ally or an enemy, in my opinion, especially in the world today over there. Paying Pakistan all this money. Do you for 1 minute think they're our ally? They for a fact knew.
Of course they did. Of course they did.
The reason I say that is, if they didn't, why aren't they giving this guy a reward? The doctor who...
he's in jail.
Why aren't they giving him a reward instead of putting him in jail?
He's in jail.
He did something they didn't want him to do.
Well, I'll tell you why. They were also getting a whole lot of money from the United States to fight, quote-unquote, terrorism, okay? That was the other thing. I mean, the fact, and you know, he was a mile away from what they considered to be their West Point, but I guess they didn't know he was there. That's a beautiful town. I got a friend of mine who works, you know, for CIA over there, and that he was there for a year. That's a vacation spot, okay, in Pakistan. That's a vacation spot, and he was staying in a villa. So I have a lot of trouble believing that the higher command, the ISI or whatever, their intelligence service, didn't know exactly where Osama bin Laden was.
The thing is, even if they did not, why is this guy in prison?
That's exactly right. Well, but Howard, let me ask you this. I think a lot of the knock on the United States from the Arab world is the fact that we are duplicitous in our foreign policy, in the sense, and I'll give you an example, we take down a dictator like Saddam Hussein, but yet we support someone like Hosni Mubarak for 30 years. I know it's complicated, but Mubarak was far from a Democrat. I mean, far from somebody who was actually, who believed in democracy. That was a dictatorship as well. And I think so the inconsistencies in American foreign policy, which is almost impossible to avoid when you have a lot of power, by the way, because we were trying to keep the peace with Egypt and Israel. But having said that, that's the hard thing about being a powerful country. You are going to be the nature of real politik, geopolitics. You're going to be have to play different sides, aren't you? I mean, you're going to have to be somewhat inconsistent.
Like the Shah of Iran.
Okay. Yeah.
Shah of Iran was there. He was not a good leader. And it was said one time that, you know, he's a bastard, but one of our presidents said, yes, but he's our bastard.
Yes, so, exactly. They said the same thing about Mobutu in Nigeria, Zaire. That's right. He's a son of a bitch, but at least he's our son of a bitch. Right.
And the duplicity's there, and basically we're just trying to, like, keep somebody who's going to, like, work with us or whatever. And that's from a strategic standpoint, not from a necessarily ideal foreign policy standpoint. But here is what is even worse than that. I'll submit this to you. Think about us being in Mogadishu, Somalia, having all these people come over to our side. We got the Habagita and the Abgal clan. We're pretty much got all the bad guys' lieutenants. The purse strings are cut. We got Otto Osman and all these people who have helped us to the risk of their families' lives.
Yep.
They've all helped us. They put it all on the line for us. And then they see an America who, at the first
cuts and runs
mouth, we cut and run.
Yep.
I see that as being more problematic. They understand the politicians are going to be politicians. Listen, there's nothing I hate worse than a career politician. They're all in it for their party. They're going to vote along party lines. They really don't give a rat's ass about us out here in the real world.
Yep.
They're out there trying to get reelected.
Yep.
Okay?
Yep.
But people like that are willing to put their family's life on the line to help. I had people that were guarding my safe house, Brian, that I know for a fact they and their family were killed after October 3rd because they were helping us.
Unbelievable.
Now you got a world that looks at America and goes, okay, they used to be the big boys on the block, but when it comes down to it, and this is what Al-Qaeda and the Taliban think, when it comes down to it, they just don't have the stomach for the long, drawn-out, long haul. And, you know, as soon as we stick it to them a couple good times, they'll be gone and we'll be back to business as normal. That's why we got to finish the job.
That's a very good point. Our credibility is everything. So, you know, if we're going to get involved in something, we better know exactly what the mission is about. And we better be willing to finish it. It takes a long time.
And when you say finish it, you asked me the question earlier. Know what finishing means. I mean, does finish it when we go into Afghanistan mean the death of Osama bin Laden? Does finish it mean reestablishing their government? And I got my own thoughts on, you know, trying to help my government build when we got as many problems as we have ourselves. Like, that's like, you know, taking visual advice from a blind guy, but...
Well, that's right. I mean, Howard, you know, when you talk about building a nation building, for God's sake, we got our own problems in this country. You're right. I mean, it's very easy to think in an isolationist way. However, when this is such complicated stuff. Just as we talk, you realize, I like the way you're kind of drawing out the bottom line is isolate, define the mission, and then be ready to follow it through. If you don't, then it's all for naught. I mean, that's basically what you're saying.
That's exactly right. And the thing is, regardless of whether we like it or not, once we've made the commitment to do it, we do it. Now, here's the thing I get asked a lot at my presentations, and this is a good way to look at the American psyche. Dr. Wasden, why send American men and women over there to try to, you know, help them, like they were talking about Mogadishu, Somalia, help them when we've got people here in the United States that are hungry? You know, we got people here in the United States that can't get college loans. We got people here that are homeless. And I just look at them and I said, you know what? You're spoiled, okay? Mm. I could take you over there and show you what real hunger is, what real homelessness is, disease. Then I show them pictures of children with cholera, show them pictures of a boy with his foot blown off from stepping on a landmine at school, show him somebody who has to walk a mile to get water when all you got to do is walk into anywhere and turn on water and you have that. And I said, now here's the thing. We've got it this good. And if we've got it this good and we want to make it better for ourselves, good. I said, but let me tell you, if I were to take you to some of these third world countries and you see these people, you're a pretty hard-hearted individual to say, hey, let's don't help them.
It's amazing to hear you talk as SEAL Team 6 Commando, former SEAL Team 6 Commando. And everything that you're talking about, you almost sound like a Peace Corps volunteer. I mean, you sound like somebody who never even shot a gun. It's so fascinating to me to hear somebody who's accomplished so much, someone like you who's accomplished so much and been so familiar in those violent spaces. And yet to hear you talk now as a man, it's all about compassion and it's all about, you know, trying to help people.
And I'm glad I'm breaking that mold for you, because that's a common misconception. And I'll tell you what, every person who's on the SEAL team today does it for love of God and country. They don't do it because they want to be the one pulling the trigger or whatever. I always make a joke. They say, you know, my patients and people that I give presentations to are like, Dr. Wasen, how do you go from being a sniper to being a chiropractor? I do the same exact job I used to do. I'm like, I just put people out of their misery in a different way.
Jesus, that's the greatest answer. You make me want to go join the SEAL. I'm just too old, man. I got to get on some steroids. I don't have the bone structure, by the way. But God, I would just kill to be it's just amazing. Yeah, I was SEAL Team 6 Commando. I used to take people out with my fingers, and now I just adjust people and make them feel better.
Yeah, that's a great job. And listen, I get satisfaction out of my job now. Same love that I had for my country and God then, I got for my patients now. And speaking of which, I'm going to have to go in just a couple minutes. I got 23 people to see in the next 4 hours.
Unbelievable, man. Unbelievable. This has been such a fascinating, exciting thing. I hope we can get you back, man, because I got so many more questions to ask you. And you know, you really, when I talk to people like you, I just get a real strong, I guess I just get my renewed faith in humanity, and not only in humanity, but in the power of change and in the power of being able to overcome terrible circumstances. Because the chapter in your book about what it was like to live under your stepfather, and I have children, and I have a 4-year-old, is heartbreaking, man. It's just heartbreaking.
Remember the old SEAL team saying, "That which doesn't kill us makes us stronger." And remember, haven't talked to me and like kind of breaking the mold. I want the people who watch your show or listen to you to realize there's thousands of me, people like me out there, better than me, better people than me, that are out there every day fighting for their freedoms. And by God, we got to quit taking that for granted in the United States.
Well, I love it. And by the way, is it true that your book has been optioned for a movie?
Yes. After we did real well. We've on the bestseller list, New York Times bestseller list for 22 weeks. Vin Diesel bought the movie rights to the book, and I think they're screenwriting that as we speak.
Is Vin Diesel stronger than you are, sir?
What?
Is Vin Diesel more? Is he more diesel than you are when you were training?
I'll put it to you this way: he's not as mentally tough.
And you know what, my friend, I believe you. Dr. Howard Wasen, thank you, former SEAL Team 6 Commando, best-selling author, and I'm going to try to get this right: a chiropractic biophysician.
Thank you, Brian.
Yeah, thank you, sir. I appreciate it. Thanks so much for joining us, and you're a good friend of America, sir, and you make me proud to be an American.
Thank you, Brian. Have a great day.
Okay, you too, sir. Later. What a man. What a man. Dr. Howard Wasen. Got ourselves involved in a little talk about foreign policy as well. Just an impressive dude, man. That's exciting. Guys, read the book, SEAL Team 6. It's so much more than just about killing and being a badass. Because there are different kinds of badasses. I just think it's so fascinating to talk to somebody who's that good and killed a lot of people, man. I mean, he talks about it in the book. I mean, killed a lot of people and now makes a lot of people with those same hands, makes a lot of people feel better. Damn it. Why am I just a stand-up comic? Why? All right. This is Man Thoughts. You guys have been awesome. Not that I even know how you're listening to this, but I feel excited. Again, I'll be at Yuck Yucks in Calgary, October 11th to the 13th. And then Fort Lauderdale Improv, October 18th to the 20th. Two of my favorite places to perform, by the way. They pack it in. It's going to be a lot of fun. Like us on Facebook. Search for Man Thoughts with Brian Callen. Follow us on Twitter at ManThoughtsBC. I got to start man-thoughting more. My producer, Mike Casantini, is always giving me a hard time about that. And thanks to my producers, Rena and Mike Casantini and Daniel Heiss, all these guys who are doing a great job. I have a huge staff behind me. And by the way, help support the show. Click on the Amazon link and buy stuff, whatever. Visit online store. Do we have any? We don't. Oh yeah, I put a lot of books, recommended books on online. One of which, of course, is SEAL Team 6. This book, which is fantastic. And take our Man Thoughts survey. Be featured on the show. That's right. Just go to the website, manthoughts.com. And we have several contests. Man Thoughts. Visit manthoughts.com. Design a T-shirt contest. I need a T-shirt, you guys. I'll pay you $500. And I'll wear it for my special or wherever. And I win an autographed DVD of Man Class. There are only 10 available. All right, man. There it is. Man Thoughts. Thank you. And God bless you. And God bless America.
You've been listening to Man Thoughts with Brian Callen.